RN, your world unfolding.
Hi, you're with Big Ideas here on RN or online at abc.net.au. Paul Barclay with you. Tonight, the dirty war for Europe's integrity and soul. Yanis Varoufakis, a critic of neoclassical economics, traces the history, hopes and failures of European integration. Instead of being on the road to recovery, the European Union, he warns, is at risk of disintegration. Yanis Varoufakis is an economist and visiting professor at the Graduate School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. Before leaving Greece, he was professor of economic theory and director of the political economy program at Athens University. His most recent book is The Global Minotaur, The True Origins of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. Let's head now to the State Library of New South Wales for highlights of the inaugural Europe lecture presented by the University of Western Sydney to discuss the causes and ongoing effects of the 2008 financial crisis. Here's Professor Yanis Varoufakis.
Thank you all for taking the time to be here tonight. Europe has been a beacon on humanity's proverbial hill since the end of the Second World War, unifying hitherto warring countries on the basis of popular mandates founded on the promise of shared prosperity, the erection of common institutions, the tearing down of ludicrous borders scarring the landscape. This was always both a tall order and an enchanting dream. The European Union could even pose as a blueprint for the rest of the world from which to draw courage and inspiration on how to move together, closer together, to create a common land without an authoritarian empire, to forge bonds that rely not on kin, language, ethnicity, a common enemy even, but on common values and shared principles. A commonwealth where reason, democracy, respect for human rights, and a decent social safety net provide its multinational, multilingual, multicultural citizen a canvas on which to become the men and women that their talents allow them to grow into. When I was growing up in the colonel's Greece under a neo-fascist dictatorship, the thought of one day joining this emergent Europe of free nations had a magnetic effect. We all saw the prospect of becoming part of an inclusive Europe as an escape from irrationality and tyranny. Similarly, for the peoples on the wrong side of the Iron Curtain, who two decades later entertained similar hopes. Over the past decades, a European Union mirroring this vision seemed to be coming into being, step by step, crisis by crisis. Alas, since the crash of 2008, which here in Australia we call it the GFC, Europe has entered a phase that poses a clear and present danger to its legitimacy, to the very notion of shared prosperity that underpins it. It is not inconceivable, ladies and gentlemen, that the European Union could collapse like a house of cards, just like the Soviet Union did. Tonight, I wish to ring an alarm bell based on a revisionist take on European integration. The very title of my talk, The Dirty War for Europe's Integrity and Soul, foreshadows a line of argument which will not caress ears, but which I hope will conclude with a whiff of optimism about Europe. Let me outline in brief my argument. I shall argue that the European Union is disintegrating, that its multi-layered disintegration was triggered by the inane handling of an inevitable crisis, the euro crisis. That contrary to conventional wisdom, the euro crisis was not due to the fact that our European political economies are too different, too diverse. No, it was due to the faulty architecture of the particular form of monetary union that we chose. And that this particular form of monetary union was chosen because of the manner in which the European Union was initially designed in the 1950s by Washington's New Dealers, and the way it responded in 1971 to the end of the First post-war phase, the Bretton Woods era. I shall then claim that against the official narrative, the Eurozone is not on the mend, and that unless we change course, it will bring the whole of the European Union down with it. But what fresh course should Europe take? First, Europeans need to confront some toxic myths on which the illogical policies of the present are founded. Secondly, we must dissolve and escape from a false trilemma between the idea that Europe is more or less on the right path. It is not. The notion that the solution lies in federating. It does not. And the desperate conclusion that the Eurozone was such a bad idea, so let's dismantle it. We should not. In place of these unappetizing alternatives, I shall try to tease out that which I think history and logic dictate as the rational way forward. I call it decentralized Europeanization. But before any of this comes to pass, allow me to begin with a series of stories. A series of stories that hopefully will transport you into the Europe that I inhabit mentally. My tales will come with titles. The first one I call Pilgrimage. On a dull autumnal afternoon, two suited men, exuding authority, enter the chapel in which the remains of Charles I, or Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, had been resting for 11 centuries. The year was 1978. The two men had just completed an agreement that set up the European monetary system, the Eurozone's precursor. They were both resolute about their decision, but also highly worried. One of them, the French president, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, was haunted by the memory of France's late exit from a previous experiment with monetary union, the mid-war gold standard. Unlike Britain, you see, that had taken its leave smartly in 1931, France had held on until 1936, the result being that its economy was crushed by recession, and thus France was prepared for its ignominious defeat in 1939. Would France do better now in a fresh monetary union, this time with Germany? The monetary union that he had agreed to. The second pilgrim, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt of Germany, was also worried, for he knew that the mighty Bundesbank, the Central Bank of Germany, was about to pounce on him, fearing that its authority over German money might be offered to Paris as a form of dowry for this Franco-German union. To drown their trepidation, Giscard and Schmidt sought solace and legitimacy in the legacy of the Christian king, who is synonymous amongst European traditionalists with a longing for a central European unity. Shortly after the pilgrimage, the French president told friendly newsmen and later included it in his autobiography. Perhaps, while Helmut and I were discussing monetary affairs, the spirit of Charlemagne brooded over us. In the mid-1990s, the offspring of Giscard's and Schmidt's European monetary system was being established. It was the European Central Bank. Interestingly, a number of officials likened its establishment to the coronation of Charlemagne, to the beginning, I suppose, of a new Christian sovereignty that would traverse borders the way that Charlemagne's empire first did after the fall of Rome. I hope it's not too indelicate at this point to add a footnote that it took the hideous murder of thousands of Muslim men in Srebrenica a year later, in 1995, and the spectacular failure of Dutch United Nations peacekeepers to protect them before Europe discovered that there was such a thing as a homegrown Muslim European citizen for whom a revival of Charlemagne's empire meant very little. My next tale is entitled Error. It is November 1990. Mrs. Thatcher has just been pushed out of 10 Downing Street. But she has one more appearance to make in the House of Commons on Question Time, which she uses in order to stage another bravado performance that, as far as I'm concerned, was memorable. Responding to questions on Europe's monetary union, she famously said, "It's all politics. Who controls interest rates is political. A single currency is about the politics of Europe." She was, of course, completely and utterly right. A year later, Wilhelm Nolling, a member of the Bundesbank's governing council, said the same thing. "We should be under no illusion," he said, "that the present controversy over the new European monetary order is about power, influence, and the pursuit of national interests." Mrs. Thatcher was also right when she predicted that, and I quote, "this single currency, like all fixed exchange rate regimes, will crack. It will not result in harmonious developments." However, Mrs. Thatcher's next sentence was in serious error, the error of my title. She said, "Monetary union is an attempt to usher in federation through the back door." We now have evidence, ladies and gentlemen, that this was not and is not the case. Just look at the so-called banking union that the European Union has proclaimed recently. The unification of banking sectors across the Eurozone, which is absolutely essential, is now being proclaimed in name to be denied in practice, to be confirmed in the breach, not in the observance. The next story is called Frenzy. Franz, not his real name, worked for a major German bank for 25 years. In 2011, we met, and he confided to me that the euro's good years, the period between 1998 and 2008, had been the worst time of his life. From 1999 to 2008, the pressure from his bank's Frankfurt headquarters on executives like him was relentless. You see, before the euro, his job entailed flying around European capitals, assessing the credit worthiness of governments, local authorities, utilities, developers, local banks, big businesses, playing hard to get with them, having dinner and lunch, and eventually signing off on loans that made sense to him. Once the euro was established, the frenzy began in earnest. Headquarters was pressurizing him incessantly to lend. When he warned them that increased lending would mean subprime loans to iffy customers, they couldn't care less. It was all about securing a higher share of the euro market than the other banks of Frankfurt or Paris. And since total lending affected was linked to his and his boss's bonuses, Franz and his colleagues were sent to Dublin, to Madrid, to Athens, to every nook and every cranny of the Eurozone with a simple mission: to increase the level of indebtedness of those nooks and crannies. "I lived the life of a predator lender," he said to me. Next tale, denial. Picture the following scene. It is September 2008. Lehman Brothers CEO, Mr. Fuld, meets with Hank Paulson, the United States Treasury Secretary, and asks, as he did, for a gigantic credit line to keep Lehman Brothers afloat. Imagine the following answer, fictitious answer, from Hank Paulson. "No to a bailout, no to a subsidized interest rate loan, and no, you are not allowed to file for bankruptcy." Of course, such an answer would never be possible because it makes absolutely no sense. And yet, this was precisely the answer that the Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, received from his European partners in January 2010 when he reported to them that Greece was bankrupt. A majestic 999. No to a bailout, no to lower interest rates, and the first most peculiar no, don't even think of defaulting on the government debts. Now, naturally, this remarkable 999 was a knee-jerk expression of Europe's gross denial that it was facing an architectural, a structural crisis. That we had created a monetary union featuring states without a central bank to back them at a time of a global crisis, and a European central bank without a state to have its back. The 999, or Europe's gross denial, was upheld from January to May of 2010, when, at long last, it became clear, following a telephone call from President Obama to Berlin, that the Eurozone was about to expire, as Greece had no alternative than to default. Then, at that moment, in May of 2010, denial mutated into another form, into Greece's so-called bailout, which was to become the blueprint that soon visited Dublin, Lisbon, Madrid, which left its imprint in Europe, in the Netherlands and France, pushing the whole continent into a new recessionary phase. Unnecessarily. A recession that, unlike Paul Keating's early 1990s one, we Europeans did not have to have. The gist of the denial offered to Greece was simple. As you are now insolvent, we shall grant you the largest loan in human history on the condition that you will shrink your national income by an amount never seen since the grapes of wrath. This was no bailout. Greece was never bailed out. And nor were the rest of Europe's swine, or pigs, as we are quasi-officially being called. Our bailout was a cynical ploy for transferring large losses from the books of the French and the German banks onto Europe's taxpayers, and in particular onto the shoulders of Germany's taxpayers. All in the name of European solidarity, of course. And as if this sinister subterfuge, this attempt to mislead 17 parliaments at once, were not enough, the transfer that they called a bailout came attached with some very vicious strings. Effectively, a dismantling of basic social welfare systems to be supervised by a so-called troika of officials representing the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Commission, a small group of bailiffs that soon acquired powers that governments could never dream of. With every troika visit, the dream of shared European prosperity was dealt another blow. It marked a new episode of what I refer to as a nation's fiscal waterboarding that left it weaker, more indebted, demoralized. So in this manner, Ponzi growth of the kind that my friend Franz, the banker, was describing, metamorphosized into what I call Ponzi austerity. Let me explain what I mean by Ponzi austerity by means of another story. It is spring of 2012. The Greek government has collapsed under popular unrest and anger at the nation's sad state. And new elections are due in May. A party, a left-wing party, that advocates rescinding the bailout agreement is rising fast in the polls, and the Troika chooses to suspend all loan tranches to Greece until the Greek population delivers the right verdict at the polls. Hospitals, schools, wages, pensions all diminish as the Greek government, which was still in power, was putting the nation through the ringer in order to make ends meet. But the concern of the greater the good, both in Europe, Northern Europe, and in Athens, is about Greece's relatively small debt to the European Central Bank. You see, a year before, in an ill-fated attempt to shore up the value of Greek government bonds, the European Central Bank had purchased a bunch of them at low, low prices to boost their price. Now, the ploy failed, as did Greece. Now, the European Central Bank held these bonds, and they started maturing. Somebody had to pay them. Had they not been purchased by the European Central Bank, they would have been haircut, together with the rest of the bonds in private hands a few months earlier. But no, the European Central Bank cannot accept write-downs from member states because it is against its charter, a charter that prohibits it from financing member states. So the Greek government, while putting Greece's social economy through the ringer, had to find, in a few short days, 5 billion euros to repay the European Central Bank. Of course, it couldn't find it. And this is the solution that Europe came up with. The ECB, the European Central Bank, allowed the Greek government to issue worthless IOUs that no private investor would ever touch and passed them on to the insolvent Greek banks. The insolvent Greek banks then handed them over, those IOUs, to the European Central Bank in exchange for loans, which they passed on to the Greek government so the Greek government could repay the European Central Bank. Now, if this sounds like a rort to you, as you would say here in Australia, it is because it is the mother of all rorts. A merry-go-around, which, interestingly, while the population is being squeezed by austerity, it leaves both insolvent banks and the insolvent state more indebted than it was before. This is Ponzi austerity. This is by just a single example of the vicious cycle of Ponzi austerity that is being replicated incessantly throughout the Eurozone. Its stated purpose is to reduce debts, but debt is rising everywhere. In reality, the true purpose was to effect that cynical transfer of the periphery's bad debts from the books of the Northern European banks to the shoulders of Northern European taxpayers. Sadly, the cynical transfer, effected under the guise of the so-called bailouts and European solidarity, led to a death dance of insolvent banks and bankrupt states. Sad couples that were sequentially marched off the cliff of competitive austerity, with the awful result that large sections of proud European nations were dragged into the contemporary equivalent of the Victorian poorhouse. Perhaps you now begin to recognize why I think it imperative that we do not mince our words, and why titles such as A Dirty War for Europe's Integrity and for Its Soul may be apt. But time for my next story. Impotence. It is 2011. Giulio Tremonti, Italy's Minister of Finance, is keen for ideas on how to stop the domino effect that I just described, taking his country down. He agrees to see a friend of a political adversary who has an idea about how the Eurozone debt juggernaut could be stopped in its tracks. The minister hears the idea and likes it a lot. Immediately, he asks his aides to organize meetings between his visitor and members of the European Parliament, officials in Brussels, other politicians in Europe, with a view to helping him, the visitor, lobby in favor of that idea which the minister liked. At that point, his visitor turns around and says, "Minister, what is the point? Why should I try to convince all these officials if I have convinced you? You are the finance minister of a major European nation. You sit on the Council of Finance Ministers. If you like my proposal, why don't you table it as your own and claim the glory?" The minister smiled. He sat back in his plush armchair and responded in a manner that tragically made perfect sense. "Do you realize what will happen if I table your proposal as you are suggesting? SMSs will stream out of the room while I'm talking. The press will shortly be reporting that the Italian Minister of Finance is tabling a proposal for a central management of a part of the debt of every Eurozone member state. Seconds later, the money markets will push Italian bond yields through the roof as the rumor spreads amongst dealers that the Italian finance minister is proposing ideas because Italy clearly cannot refinance its debts. My dear friend, I shall cease to be minister tomorrow. How exactly will that help promote your proposal?" Which brings me to my sixth story. Despotism. Mr. Klaus Mazuch is the European Central Bank's representative in the Troika delegation that spreads panic everywhere it goes in the periphery of Europe. It is early 2012 as the Troika passes through Dublin. In the press conference after his meeting with Irish officials, Mr. Mazuch felt comfortable enough amongst mostly sycophantic journalists to relate a casual conversation he had had with a taxi driver. At which point, Vincent Brown, the seasoned Irish journalist, asked his question. "Did you have a chance to ask your taxi driver what he makes of the fact that your European Central Bank forced our government to guarantee private bankers' debt that our public finances could never afford? Debts that the Irish people never consented to through their elected representatives? Did you ask the taxi driver how he feels that he now has to live in austerity because your central bank forced our government to bail out private bankers so that non-Irish banks to which the money was ultimately owed would not need to be bailed out by Frankfurt, by Berlin, or by Paris. Clearly discomfited, Mr. Mazouk began to whisper how much he admired the Irish people for their resilience and for their grasp of the economic situation. "You have not answered the question, sir," wailed Vincent Brown. "But I have." "No, you have not. Please answer the question. Why did Europe's central bank, our central bank, force a small nation to take on private debts without their consent?" At which point, Mr. Mazou gathered his papers and left the room. If you want a visual depiction of Europe's democratic deficit, so-called, if you want to see why a majority of Europeans are increasingly reporting to pollsters that they have no confidence in European Union institutions, Google Vincent Brown versus ECB official. Watch the video clip on YouTube and weep. You may, I submit, be reminded of Bertolt Brecht's comment that brute force is out of date. Why send out murderers when you can employ bailiffs? My seventh tale is entitled Ignorance. Europe's finance ministers are gathering in the fall of 2011 in Poland. Tim Geithner, the American Secretary of the Treasury, is in attendance with some solid advice to Europeans on how to sever the death embrace between insolvent banks and bankrupt states. He was not just ignored, he was attacked. As the meeting ended, Ms. Maria Fechter, the Austrian finance minister, who was apparently speaking on behalf of the other ministers, opined that the Americans had no business telling Europeans how to deal with a debt crisis when America's debt was higher than that of the Eurozone. "We need no lectures from the United States," she said defiantly. When I saw her on television speaking those words, I have to tell you that I panicked. I despaired, because it revealed the deep ignorance of our European leadership. For she seemed seriously to believe that Europe's problem was debt. Not the architectural design of the Eurozone, but debt. Debt was never Europe's problem. It was a mere symptom of a terrible institutional design. Our finance ministers resemble doctors who misdiagnose a cancer patient in severe pain as somebody who is afflicted with a pain crisis. Time for wickedness. Last year I was in Brussels discussing the latest twists and turns on the crisis with one of the Commission's high priests, a commissioner. I asked an almost impertinent question to which I was surprised to receive an honest answer. Why was the Commission pushing Portugal to increase sales tax at a time of collapsing demand? Will this not push sales down and with it the revenues of the state at a time when the whole point is to reduce deficits and debts? Similarly, with a doubling of taxes on heating fuel in Greece, why are you doing this? Don't you see that people will simply not heat up their homes and that government revenues from the fuel tax will actually fall because you've increased the rate of taxation? His answer was, "Of course I know that. But we are only pushing for higher sales and fuel taxes in Portugal and in Greece as a deterrent. The point is to demonstrate to Rome that it has some awful things coming its way if they do not implement the policies of austerity that we are suggesting." This is, ladies and gentlemen, what this crisis is doing to our Europe. A clueless political personnel in denial of the systemic nature of the crisis is pursuing policies akin to carpet bombing the economy of proud European nations in order to save them. Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain are all beaten up in a pulp to keep Italy and France in awe. And then I hear European officials who habitually present these policies in the name of community, solidarity, efficiency, responsibility, discipline, worry about the loss of legitimacy of European institutions. Really? My last story is the least appetizing. Its title, Serpent DNA. It is late 1944. A new French brigade of the SS is being put together. Its name? Charlemagne. Its French members fought to the bitter end in Berlin, defending the Nazi regime against the advancing Red Army. Just a reminder that our European symbols can fall prey to the dark side. That the serpent's DNA is still in Europe, even after what we thought was a thorough denazification after the Second World War, is now beyond doubt. And it's not just Charlemagne that can work both ways. In Europe, we like to think of the European Economic Community as an idea, as an institutional blueprint that was conjured up as a bulwark against totalitarianism. Not true. The first academic conference, with the full participation of government ministers and officials, to discuss, and I quote from the official program, the formation of a European Economic Community, took place in Berlin in 1942, under the auspices of Walter Funk, Hitler's finance minister. A year later, another official had this to say about Europe. In my view, a nation's conception of its own freedom must be harmonized with present-day facts and simple questions of efficiency, discipline, and purpose. Our only requirement of European states is that they become sincere and enthusiastic members of Europe. In 50 years, Europeans will not be thinking in terms of separate countries. Joseph Goebbels. None of this insinuates that our European Union has Nazi roots. Don't get me wrong. My point is that Europeans should beware. A European Economic Union or community is not per se democratic or necessarily a bulwark against totalitarianism. It can be, it's not by definition. It does have a dark side, which we have a moral obligation to keep at bay through constant reinvigoration of our democratic processes and principles. The very principles that are now set aside by the logic of the various troikas. Ladies and gentlemen, the global financial sector has imploded twice in history. Once in 1929, then again in 2008. In 1929, two things happened soon after. The first was that the common currency of the era began to unravel. It was the gold standard. The second was that soon after, in Europe, we ended up with Nazis and assorted fascists in power. My fear when our generation's 1929 hit in 2008 was that history might repeat itself, and not as a farce. In 1929, all the burden of adjustment was forced upon the debtors. Such a policy cannot succeed, since depression poisons debt dynamics, and mass unemployment poisons democracy. Europe today, under its postmodern version of the gold standard, also known as the euro, is repeating that cardinal sin. As a result, Greece, a country which in the 1940s put up spectacular resistance to the Nazis, became so demoralized that it has allowed Nazi DNA, left over by that era's collaborators, to spawn into the hideous Golden Dawn. In France, however, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, in Scandinavia, even in Spain, Europe's dark side is rearing its ugly head too, as a direct repercussion of the loss of the dream of a shared European prosperity. As a result of Ponzi austerity, which, courtesy of being Ponzi, can only be pursued by authorities which resort to increasing levels of authoritarianism, we have poverty, loss of hope, and increasing authoritarianism, the ideal incubator for the serpent's egg. If I am even remotely right that a dirty war against Europe's integrity and soul is raging, we must end it forthwith. To end it, we need to identify the underlying historical causes and to propose simple, logical, humane remedies that all Europeans can embrace.
On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas. Tonight, highlights of Professor Yanis Varoufakis's lecture, The Dirty War for Europe's Integrity and Soul. Let's return to the State Library of New South Wales and pick up towards the end of his talk where Professor Varoufakis explains how decentralised Europeanisation could offer a way forward.
At the beginning of my talk, I promised to end up on an optimistic note. If I'm right that Europe's current path leads inexorably to disintegration and to the loss of shared prosperity, and if federalism is impossible now, at least in the medium term, as our peoples have turned against one another, what can we do? First, we need to be modest, to use existing institutions in creative ways, to forget about treaty changes and federal steps that will be outpaced by the crisis and undermined by toxic politics. Secondly, we need to deploy these institutions that we have in a manner that Europeanizes four realms. The four realms where the crisis is unfolding. Banks, debt, inadequate investment, and the humanitarian crisis. Let's Europeanize all of them. Let existing institutions manage part of the debt of member states centrally, without fiscal transfers. That is, with each government repaying its own debt, but at an interest rate that is set by the Eurozone as a whole. Let's place all banks under one authority, now, and create a single Eurozone-wide deposit insurance scheme to be financed by the existing European Stability Mechanism. Let us allow the European Investment Bank, which is three times the size of the World Bank, play the role of the surplus recycling mechanism that Europe is lacking. And lastly, let us use the accounting profits accumulating within the European system of central banks to fund an American-style food stamp program for alleviating hunger, even a minimum unemployment benefit scheme that alleviates poverty everywhere in Europe. Notice that these moves require no federal treasury, no loss of sovereignty, no fiscal transfers, no German or Dutch guarantees for Irish or Portuguese debt, no need for major changes in the treaties, no new institutions. To boot, they give more leeway to elected governments. They limit their impotence. They restore a medium and a sense of democratic control, and they do away with the Troika visits. Now, a pop history of the European Union might explain our people's desire to form a common home as follows. The French feared the Germans. The Irish wanted to escape Britain. Greeks were terrified of Turkey. The Spanish wanted to become more like the French. The Italians wanted to become German. The Dutch and the Austrians had all but become German. The Belgians sought to heal their sharp divisions by joining into both Holland and France under the auspices of the Deutschmark. And finally, the Germans feared the Germans. But there is no such thing as the Germans, or the Greeks, or the French, for that matter. We are all individuals, as Monty Python have taught us. Or Europeans, as many of us would like to think. Yes, some Europeans are grasshoppers, and others are ants. The notion that the ants all live in the north and the grasshoppers have congregated in the south is absurd. There are ants and there are grasshoppers in each of our nations. During the good times, ladies and gentlemen, in the Eurozone, the grasshoppers of the north and the grasshoppers of the south forged an amazing alliance and went on a feeding frenzy. And when their sins led to the crisis, it was the ants of the south and the ants of the north that were called upon to foot the bill. Tragically, our leaders' espousal of the grasshoppers' agenda everywhere in Europe ended up turning the ants of the north against the ants of the south. And thus, Europe is now losing its soul because of stereotyping, denial, and an ironclad determination of grabby so-called elites not to let go of the levers of ill-gotten power. Diversity and cultural difference was never Europe's problem. A continent which began uniting under many different languages and cultures ended up divided by a common currency. We tried to deal with the inevitable crisis of a faulty economic design as if Balkanization of Europe was the objective. Observing the European Union's attempts to deal with the crisis over the past few years reminds me of watching Othello. one wonders how our rulers can be so deluded. The principle of the greatest austerity for the European economy suffering the greatest recessions would be quaint if it not were the ill wind that blows into the sails of misanthropy, racism, Nazism. In an ironic historical twist, Nazism is now strong in the place that fought against it tooth and nail, in Greece, and almost absent in Germany. The good news, and it is genuinely good news, is that the Germans no longer fear the Germans. Europe needs a confident, a hegemonic Germany. A Germany that understands that the current gross denial of the crisis nature is costing Germans dearly. That their taxes are being used as we speak to build new kleptocracies in the periphery. While the proportion of working poor Germans is skyrocketing. And when the whole thing unravels, as it surely will, there will be nothing but losers all over Europe and beyond. It is in this sense that Europeans do have, still have, a powerful common interest. To confront the bureaucracies, the cartels, the kleptocrats, who are preventing them from adapting the European Union to the post-2008 reality. In this titanic battle for Europe's integrity and soul, the forces of reason and humanism will have to face down a growing authoritarianism. Leonard Shapiro, writing on Stalinism, warns us that the true object of propaganda is neither to convince nor even to persuade, but to produce a uniform pattern of public utterances in which the first trace of unorthodox thought reveals itself as a jarring dissonance. We already see this in Europe. Anyone who dares challenge the official version that all is well in the best of all possible European unions is treated as a jarring dissonance, as a fool, as anti-European. Dissidents should take heart. Just like in the Soviet Union, false gods are condemned eventually to be found out. I hope that they do get found out in Europe quickly, because the human toll of this crisis is too high. When Gandhi was asked what he thought of Western civilization, he famously quipped, "It would be a great idea." If asked today what we think of the European Union, we could do worse than remark, "A splendid idea, if we can pull it off." I think we can, but not without a gigantic democratic stimulus. Thank you.
Professor Yiannis Varoufakis delivering the inaugural Europe lecture for the University of Western Sydney. On Big Ideas, let's now take in a few questions from the audience.
Thank you for your talk, Yiannis. I couldn't help thinking that the heart of Europe and its dirty war, pardon my bias, is with Greece. I don't understand if austerity isn't working, and it's glaringly so, why the peaks actually can't join together and do something and sound resounding messages to the north. The heart of this war, I think, lies with the south. And where to for Greece if this is the soul of Europe and the heart of the dirty war, besides closing the ERT national broadcaster?
Why can't the pigs get together into a swine alliance? Well, let me tell you why. Because our political class has a very nice, cozy relationship with local bankers. And local bankers are kept alive on a drip feed in a zombified state by bailout funds that are dispensed by the Troika. Now, that new kleptocracy, as I call it, is not interested in doing anything that will jeopardize its nice relationship, good relationship, warm relationship with the Troika, Brussels, and Frankfurt. And that is the case in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal, everywhere. It's a spectacular political failure.
Thank you for your great lecture. I sympathize with it very much, and I particularly liked your early comment on decentralization. I think it's a key word for the future of Europe. But you didn't go ahead later on in your optimistic tone. If we look back to the history of Europe and modern times, all those heavily centralized systems sooner or later found itself in trouble. And I think Europe as such, with everything being centralized in Brussels, is in trouble as well. And do you have any ideas how to get out of this problem? How to decentralize to the effect that the whole Europe would participate in managing and the future of Europe? Thank you.
I think the answer is in balance. This is why my proposal has two elements to it: decentralization and Europeanization. Bringing together those four realms that I mentioned so that we can become masters of our destiny at the local level, at the level of the national parliaments.
Yanni, you seem to suggest that a federated Europe is a possible solution. Do you know whether the people of Europe want a federated Europe?
They certainly don't. At the moment, the Germans hate the Greeks. The Portuguese hate the Germans. The French hate everyone. And so on and so forth. But that wasn't the case before 2008. Before this crisis erupted, sorry, I go back to the economic determinism, which is perhaps ingrained in my being, but before 2008, we were increasingly Europeanizing at the level of the imaginary. And the only way of returning to that process is by stabilizing the current crisis. Unfortunately, the political will and the political alliances to do that are now lacking. And the proposal I came up with was just a proposal of how to stabilize so that, remember I said, in the future, we can decide whether we want to federate or not. Now is not the time.
Yanni, I want to challenge your pessimism and ask you if you really think your bleak connection between exchange rates and the human spirit is quite as firm as you suggest. I think of one country that has a fixed exchange rate to the US dollar. It hasn't done too badly out of it. It's China. And I think also of your comparison between the gold standard of the 20s and today's euro. The gold standard was very different. There weren't free movements of people. There weren't free movements of goods. All those sorts of things which a liberal economist would say are Adam Smith's invisible hand to help integrate Europe that exists today. And of course, those free movements of people are about culture as well as about a labour market. So I'm more optimistic than you. I see the euro as a symbol of unity and and the European Union in an economic sense as far more than a cartel about coal and steel, which is, I know, what it started off as in 1951 or so. It's now about all sorts of levels of human interaction. So I'm more optimistic than you.
Well, allow me to deconstruct your optimism. Because it's founded on good sentiments, but not much else. China, I wish we were like China. Well, firstly, it's not true that it has a fixed exchange rate with the dollar. Renminbi has revalued vis-à-vis the American dollar since 2008 by 38%. Secondly, and most importantly, China jealously guards its right to impose strict controls on capital movements. Do you remember what I said? What you can't have is a combination of three things. You can't have free trade, free capital movement, and fixed exchange rates. You can have two of these three. Choose any two. You can't have all three. In Europe, we try to have all three, and this is why your optimism is ill-founded. Now, I never said, of course, that all that the European Union today is a cartel of coal and steel, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, coal and steel are not that significant anymore, in any case. I was trying to answer the question. Now that the Eurozone crisis has completely and utterly exploded the myth that that kind of gold standard was possible in Europe and sustainable, why are we not moving towards federation? And in the story about the cartel that you mentioned, I find the kernel, the DNA, as I say, of the explanation. Lastly, the Eurozone is a gold standard on steroids. It's much more than the gold standard was in the mid-war period. What you're saying strengthens my argument. There was no freedom of movement under the gold standard, and far less integration than we have now in the European Union. But that makes the European version of the gold standard more unstable, not less so.
Thanks for your talk. I want to just shift a little bit and ask you
In terms of what you said about the European Union having its own narrative and being in denial as to what seems to be happening on the ground, where do you see enlargement at this point? We've got five candidate states, and with the Eurozone in the situation that it is in, do you see the brakes being put on enlargement? Croatia's just joined, but that really was well and truly down the pipeline at the point.
Yes, it was in train. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something weird is happening in Europe in this regard. There are two opposing forces. On the one hand, there is the enlargement process, which I think is going to continue. And it will continue for reasons that are no different to those that underpinned the enlargement of previous decades. But at the same time, you have a disintegration. Now you have calls in Europe to do away with the freedom of movement, the Schengen Treaty. There are debates in the European Parliament as we speak, the purpose of which is to rule that Romanians and Bulgarians who this year would have the right to migrate internally should not be allowed to do that. So, at once, Europe is enlarging and disintegrating, just like the Roman Empire before its collapse, or the Soviet Union for that matter.
I'm a Greek-born Australian. I have family in Greece. We've talked about the top end of the problems. What about the people at the other end, where people aren't paying their taxes, where the whole social structure, it wasn't in tune with what the European Union was supposed to do? The Greeks aren't paying their taxes. They too much bureaucracy that shouldn't be there. All those problems at grassroots, what percentage of the problem do you think that takes up?
Very good question. I'm the last person on this planet who's going to defend the ways of the Greeks. When I moved back from Australia in 2000 to Greece, I was driven mad by everything that I was encountering. Acquiring a tax file number took years of my life. Having said that, all these malignancies of the Greek social economy and state and polity explain why Greece was the first domino. It does not explain the domino effect. Let me put it very simply. If a tiny little pipsqueak of a corrupt country like Greece, right, let's say that's what Greece is, can bring down a mighty European Union, there is something wrong with the mighty European Union, not with a pipsqueak country, right? If the great state of Delaware can bring the United States to its knees, there's something wrong with the United States. And to understand why Greece has been hitting the headlines internationally, all these important issues for us Greeks are utterly irrelevant. If Greece didn't join the euro in 2000, okay, now it wouldn't be in the crisis it finds itself in. It would be always in a state of quasi, you know, oriental joy, but it would not be imploding. It would be perfectly stable, as it had been for decades before.
Professor Yanis Varoufakis, and that's where we'll have to leave the State Library of New South Wales and the inaugural Europe lecture presented by the History Group at the School of Humanities, Communications and Arts at the University of Western Sydney. Tomorrow night on Big Ideas, award-winning artist Grayson Perry asks whether it's really true that anything can be art. Playing to the Gallery, the second of four BBC Wreath Lectures. I'm Paul Barclay. I look forward to your company again tomorrow night. Until then, bye for now.